Welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 17th of October 2022, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. It's the start of another week, and we are here to look over the week's news that is going to be of interest to nationalists, particularly British news, because that's what we concentrate on in this podcast. And of course, I have with me my regular co-host, Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing?
I'm absolutely fine, thank you. Yes, there's lots going on at the moment, lots of stuff in the news that we can talk about. And I think today could actually end up being quite a historic day in view of the news that's coming through at the moment. It's not entirely clear what's happened, but the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Kwasi Kwarteng, was sent off to the International Monetary Fund conference in New York over the last sort of couple of days, and came back early. And I can already see on my computer screen whether this is true or not. I couldn't tell at the moment, but it says breaking news. It says Kwasi Kwarteng sacked as Chancellor after mini budget. And so I think today is going to be one of those days that people are going to remember for decades to come, rather like Black Wednesday that occurred in 1992. When the UK opted out of the exchange rate mechanism for the European Union, when lots of money will have been made by people betting on the stock markets and the currency markets. And this is all part of a fiasco that has been the Conservatives' management of the economy since Liz Truss became Prime Minister.
Yeah, they're actually taking bets as well. How long will Liz Truss last as Prime Minister? Will she last as long as the shelf life of a lettuce? And apparently the bookies are offering 6-1 that she will be out within 35 days. And there is a live stream of this iceberg lettuce, which is basically going off. It's incredible when you think that Boris Johnson was got rid of basically because of media influence and the journalists putting all this pressure on the Conservative Party to get rid of him, when he was supported by the Conservative Party members, he was supported by all the members of the public that voted for him, and they ended up getting rid of him because of this media pressure. And now, once again, because of the media pressure, they've been forced to get rid of Kwasi Kwarteng. I mean, I've heard a lot of people that have been saying, well, this budget was actually very good, and they have to stand their ground on this. Otherwise, they're just admitting that they're being manipulated by the media. I don't know if you've got any thoughts on that, Max, and also perhaps you would like to let us know why it is that these speculators could actually make money, and what happened in this big stock market crash, or whatever it was that you were referring to there as well, that took place at an earlier time.
When events happen that are unexpected, and where there is not an explanation for them, then very often what you find is that the financial markets will worry about what the outcome is going to be. And very often there'll be perhaps a drop on the stock market, or it may be a drop in the value of the pound relative to the dollar or relative to the euro. And what we've had with the Conservatives mini budget is the announcement of the mini budget, where it would appear there was no prior approval of the budgetary arrangements that were going to be made by the Office of Budgetary Responsibility, or by the International Monetary Fund, or anybody else. And because this wasn't done, and because the budget announcement that was made was quite a radical announcement, which involved unfunded tax cuts, confidence of international traders and speculators in the value of the pound dropped, because it would appear that the government were going to have to borrow a lot more money than they have done so far. And when governments borrow too much money, then it brings into question their ability to service that level of debt, etc. So the pound started to drop as a result of the mini budget announcement, and the Bank of England then had to step in and start buying bonds in order to prop up the value of the pound, and in order to stop the situation from worsening. Now, the upshot of that was that the Bank of England announced that they were going to prop up the pound for a certain specific amount of time. And I think it was something like 13 days they said they were going to do it for, £5 billion a day for 13 days. I think that was the announcement they made. So it totaled something like £65 billion at the end of that period, had they gone throughout the entire 13 days. And it was an announcement in advance that they were going to do this. And of course, any currency speculators, seeing that the pound was going to be artificially propped up for 13 days, would anticipate that at the end of the 13 days, where the pound was no longer going to be propped up, that the pound would fall in value. And so there are all sorts of financial instruments called options, where people can bet on whether the stock market is going to go up or down, or whether the value of the pound is going to go up or down. And so what would have happened as a result of the announcement that the Bank of England were going to prop up the pound for a certain period of time is that lots of currency speculators will have then geared themselves up, and they would have put in place these options, which are effectively our bets, and they would have bet that at the end of that 13-day period, the pound would fall against the dollar. And of course, it would be an almost certain bet from their point of view. So they could bet enormous amounts of money and they'd make an absolute killing. Rather like what happened back in 1992, which was Black Wednesday. There was the formation of the exchange rate mechanism within the European Union, which was a mechanism which was intended to create a convergence of the value of the currencies of all the European countries that were part of the European Union. And as a result of the exchange rate mechanism, there were certain limitations that were placed on the difference, the amount of movement that there could be between the value of one currency and another currency. And so if one currency started to weaken just a bit too much, it would then cause other currencies to have to drop in value in order to maintain the relationship that had been created using the exchange rate mechanism. And this arrangement kind of created a wounded beast as far as currency speculators were concerned. And currency speculators were having an absolute field day betting that certain currencies would drop in value, which was called short betting, or that certain currencies would rise in value. And they were making an absolute killing out of this. And the Chancellor of the Exchequer at the time decided, and John Major, the Prime Minister at the time, decided that we needed to leave the exchange rate mechanism in order to protect the value of the pound. Already at that point, they had already put interest rates were already running at 10% per annum, the bank base rate. And so that was, a high level of interest rate during that period. And in order to then prevent the pound from falling in value once we'd left the exchange rate mechanism, the John Major government put interest rates momentarily up to 12%, and then momentarily later on that day up to 15%. But it had no effect, really. The pound still dropped in value as a result of us leaving the exchange rate mechanism. And one currency speculator, George Soros, famously made an absolute fortune out of betting against the pound on that particular occasion, and he is rumoured to have had a short bet on the pound for something like $10 billion, and allegedly made something like $1.5 billion profit for himself as a result of betting against the pound sterling. And so these kind of currency relationships can be very dangerous. And as I said, what the Bank of England have been doing is that they've been telling people that, yes, we're going to support the pound. Also, we're going to continue to buy bonds for the next 13 days or so. And in fact, that 13 days, I think, is up today. And so what probably is going to happen is that we'll probably find that the pound will drop against the dollar tomorrow. And these currency speculators, those that have been betting against the pound, will make a fortune in the same sort of way that George Soros is alleged to have done back in 1992. And so it's a dire situation that we're in at the moment. In fact, this, as I say, is probably going to go down in history as one of the most turbulent and one of the worst days for the British economy, just purely as a result of this whole sort of mistiming of what's been going on, the lack of confidence, and as far as the Conservatives are concerned, they introduced this budget. They didn't get it checked out previously and get it agreed by the Organization for Budgetary Responsibility and the International Monetary Fund, etc. And to a certain extent, I think that some of the speculation that's taking place that's driving interest rates up at the moment, and which is damaging the value of the pound, is as a result of international financial organizations deciding to punish the Conservative government for the fact that they introduced a mini budget without running it past them first. And so there is a degree of punishment involved in this, and who knows where it's going to end. It's looking like it's going to be one of those days, and I think we'll reach the end of the day today, and it will be interesting to see how the day panned out. But there were rumours when Kwasi Kwarteng hopped on the plane and hot-footed back here to have an emergency meeting with Liz Truss. There was then speculation that the result of the impact that his mini budget has had was so dire that he would likely be sacked as Chancellor of the Exchequer. And as I said, there are reports coming through now on the internet. Whether or not they're true or not, I don't know. I haven't had a chance to check it, but it looks as if he may well have been sacked as Chancellor of the Exchequer already. Whether that will stop any further implications for Liz Truss, I don't know. Liz Truss may still carry the can for what's happened, and it could well be that as a result of what's happened here, that confidence in her will be so badly damaged that she will be forced to step down as the Conservative leader, in which case... there are rumours being spread at the moment that that Rishi Sunak and Penny Mordaunt are in the frame to take Liz Truss's place. And it's there are sort of bets taking place that either Rishi Sunak will be the Prime Minister and Penny Mordaunt will be the Chancellor of the Exchequer, or Penny Mordaunt will be the Prime Minister and Rishi Sunak will be the Chancellor of the Exchequer. And apparently there are people meeting in smoke-filled rooms and arguing the pros and cons of these kind of arrangements as we speak. And as I say, it will be interesting to see how all of this settles down. It may not all settle down today. It may be that this the ructions from all of this will continue for some days to come. And it may take a week or two until towards the end of the month before things finally settle down. But it's an interesting time, and it's a salutary lesson, really, for any governments that want to operate in an independent way where they have sovereignty over their own economy, that the international nature of the world economy at the moment is such that the interests of international financial organizations are so tightly intertwined that if a government decides to act on their own, it has such far-reaching implications for other financial institutions around the world. Those other financial institutions are likely to take umbrage if a government starts trying to act on its own, of its own volition, as if it were a sovereign government. And this is all part of globalization. Globalization is this process by which international financial organizations and governmental organizations and political organizations are trying to weave the interests of all sorts of interest groups together in order to try and create a world government, a global government, where there will be global control of every country. And, you know, this will be something which will be a massive step back for mankind. This will be something that will be tragic if it actually occurs, because there will be it will almost certainly be a dictatorial and totalitarian type of government. We've seen the way in which totalitarian countries and countries that are dictatorships have been flexing their muscles in recent times. We've also seen the way in which the European Union, which was although it is disguised, heavily disguised as a democracy, is in fact an oligarchy, which is basically a dictatorship by a collective group of people. And one of the main reasons why it was so necessary for us to get out of the European Union was because we would have been engulfed in this United States of Europe that they're moving towards creating, where the ability of individual people to influence the way in which their country is ruled will be effectively negated, and where powerful moneyed interests will dominate the government of Europe, and if a global government is allowed to come into place, there will be a single regime. And there will be nowhere for anybody who is a dissident to hide. Nowadays, you know, if you are a dissident from the Soviet Union, for example, you can flee the Soviet Union and you can usually find somewhere where you can run to and still lead a fairly normal life somewhere else in the world. If you're a Chinese dissident, you can do the same thing. If you are a dissident from Europe, then you can always go and find somewhere where you can go and live and still be free and still lead a normal life somewhere else in the world. But if there's a global government, and if it's a totalitarian government, and it's got all of the artificial intelligence and the control of media and the sort of interfacing of media from all over the country, such that there's facial recognition cameras that can pick up somebody around the other side of the world that may have been trying to sort of flee from a totalitarian system. Once that comes into play, we'll be living through Brave New World. It will be 1984, and it will be a sad day for mankind as a whole.
Well, of course, you have that centralized cryptocurrency that they're talking about as well, so that people won't even be able to use cash anymore, and they'll just be able to shut off your ability to do any banking. So basically, it's turned out that diversity wasn't such a strength for the United Kingdom Chancellor of the Exchequer. And of course, we're actually recording this on Friday, so we're talking about this as it's actually going on. We will probably have a new Chancellor of the Exchequer by Monday. And I mean, I'm thinking it will probably be Rishi Sunak. And you mentioned there about how there is talk of how Rishi Sunak is going to be parachuted in as Prime Minister with Penny Mordaunt, and that would go so much against what the Conservative Party members have voted for, because they had a chance to vote for Rishi Sunak and they said, we don't want Rishi Sunak. So if they then force Rishi Sunak in, I think there's going to be a revolution amongst the Conservative Party members. I mean, remember, they said, we want Boris Johnson. We voted for Boris Johnson. And the Conservative Party then got rid of Boris Johnson. So then they gave the Conservative Party members the choice. You can have Rishi Sunak or you can have Liz Truss. And the Conservative Party members said, we want to have Liz Truss. So if they then put Rishi Sunak in, force Rishi Sunak in to take over, I can see the Conservative Party splitting apart. So I think to head that off, I think Liz Truss will probably be putting in Rishi Sunak as the Chancellor of the Exchequer, because people do seem to have warmed to him, but I don't think they would want him as Prime Minister, and that would sort of appease that part of the party. But the fact of the matter is that they should all be getting behind Liz Truss, really, and supporting her, because she's the choice that people have made. But people have been saying this, you know, she should not have wound back on this budget. But I've also heard people saying, well, why isn't the press covering the fact that the pound is doing so well against the dollar and the euro? But as you pointed out there, Max, the only reason it's been doing well against the dollar and the euro is because the Bank of England have been propping it up and buying all these gilts. And they announced ahead of time that this was going to stop on Friday, and that the pension funds had all better get their affairs in order before Friday, because we're going to stop propping it up on Friday. And as you pointed out there, Max, that just means that all these financial speculators know exactly what is going to happen, because it's all been forecast. Now, before we went on air, you were telling me that when you used to see the budget when you were a little boy, this was never talked about beforehand. And nowadays they're signalling everything that they're going to do before it's actually done. They go to the press and you read in the press exactly what's going to happen. And they never used to do this. Am I right in thinking that, Max?
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. I mean, I can remember as a boy watching television and my parents explaining to me that I think there was an occasion where a Chancellor of the Exchequer had accidentally leaked the contents of his budget a couple of days earlier than the budgetary announcement was being made, and the Chancellor was either sort of castigated through the media for having done that, or was forced to resign. I can't remember quite what the circumstances were, but I can remember asking my parents, you know, why this was, and them explaining to me that if a Chancellor of the Exchequer or government gave away details of what they were going to include in their budget, then they would create a playground, effectively, where international speculators and traders would know exactly what movement is going to be made, and they would then bet in such a way that they would make a killing when the announcement was finally confirmed. And so Chancellors of the Exchequer used to hide and used to conceal anything that they were going to include in their budget. But that appears to have been lost. And that's largely because we've got government by the media at the moment. You know, if the government are too tight-lipped and they don't tell people around them what's going on, and this is, you know, what I was saying about the Office for Budgetary Responsibility. You know, why if we've got a sovereign government, why should that sovereign government have to go to an organisation like the OBR to get their budget approved? Or why should they have to go to the International Monetary Fund to get their budget approved? Why can't they just launch their own budget in the way that a sovereign government ought to be able to? And obviously that situation doesn't exist any longer. And not only do governments have to get their budgets checked out by in advance, but also they need to have media approval, because if they announce something that the media weren't expecting, then there is a furore throughout the media where various pundits will attack the government for doing something unexpected, and they will, if the government concerned is one that needs to be brought into line, then they will take an aggressive stance and punish the government. Whereas if the government is one that they want to nurture, then they will probably go less hard on them. And sadly, Liz Truss and Liz Truss's government is a government which seems to be receiving a punishment beating constantly by the media. Whatever they do, it's interpreted as being wrong by the media, and that's very sad. I think, you know, to some extent that may well be because Liz Truss wasn't somebody who was originally in line to become a Conservative Party leader and a Prime Minister. She was somebody who until recently had just been a simple Conservative MP, and so it may be that she the powers that be, the people that conspire in smoke-filled rooms behind the scenes and that are the operators of power politics, it may be that they see her as somebody who hasn't yet been trained to do what they want sufficiently, and that this is a punishment that she's receiving in order to bring her into line.
Yeah, well, she's trying to behave independently, isn't she? I mean, this is the thing. The media is now able to manipulate the politicians, and to a far greater extent than before. And it seems to me that because the government have given in to them, they are expecting this all the time now. And the only person really that I can recall that didn't give in to the media was Boris Johnson. I mean, if you recall that time with Dominic Cummings, and the media went crazy about it, and they were saying that Dominic Cummings has broken the COVID rules, he's gone driving to this castle and what have you, and Boris Johnson refused to give in. Dominic Cummings actually gave a press conference, and the news was just full of calling for Dominic Cummings to step down. And this was for about 2 or 3 days this went on like this. And every time that a member of parliament was interviewed by a journalist on the BBC or on Sky, that was all they would talk about. They made it very clear that they were not going to talk about anything else. They weren't going to talk about budgeting or unemployment or housing, education, any of that. None of that was going to be talked about. All was going to be brought up was Dominic Cummings. Why haven't you fired Dominic Cummings? And Boris Johnson refused to give into it. He completely refused to give into it, and he slapped them back down, and eventually they had to stop, and they just had to stop talking about it because the MPs refused to go on any news programmes if this continued. And that was the way to deal with it. But then once they, after that, they went for Boris Johnson, didn't they? And they said, well, Boris Johnson, he broke the COVID rules. Never mind the fact that it, you know, the COVID rules that he broke were the equivalent of parking on a yellow line. And they were saying, Boris Johnson is a criminal. He's broken the law. He's broken these COVID rules. He has to go. And then because this... This other Conservative Party MP, he groped somebody when he was drunk, and apparently Boris Johnson had forgot that this bloke had actually done that. And I mean, he's got, I don't know how many MPs there are in Parliament, 300 Conservative MPs, probably 600 in all, something like that. I mean, you can't expect him to know everything that goes on about every one of these MPs. But he said, no, I wasn't aware of that when I employed him. And that was it. That was all it was. And yet the media were screaming for blood, and they said, you've got to get rid of Boris Johnson, you've got to get rid of Boris Johnson. And then all the MPs that previously had been supporting him all lined up to stab him in the back. And this was right after they had a vote to see whether there was no confidence in Boris Johnson, and he won the vote. And if you win the no confidence vote, then the party are not allowed to call another no confidence vote for a year, and you should know that you are safe in office for a year if you pass that no confidence vote. And he passed it, and not even a month had gone by before the press were then calling out for his blood because of this this incident with his MP that had groped somebody. And then all the rest of the politicians stabbed him in the back. And it seems to me, since then, they haven't had the backbone to deal with the media. What are your thoughts?
And I believe I'm right in saying that actually during the no confidence vote with regard to Boris Johnson, more Conservative MPs voted in favour of him, saying they had confidence in him, than actually voted for Liz Truss during the Conservative leadership election. And so, you know, this again creates this situation where, more members of Parliament supported Boris Johnson than supported Liz Truss. Also, more members of the Conservative Party nationally supported Boris Johnson than actually wanted there to be a change of leadership, which then, you know, greatly sort of emphasises what you've been saying, that we've got government by the media at the moment. And if the media want to get a government out, then they will just continually hound that government with bad news until eventually it will interpret everything the government does negatively until the government does eventually lose its credibility with the public and is then forced to step down. And this is a terrible thing for democracy. Because it means that those people who have the wealth to invest in the media companies and who have the ability to dominate the media companies can actually govern the country. They can determine how the country is governed. And that's what we can see taking place more and more. And as I say, you know, this is all part of this progressive migration from a world composed of sovereign independent states to a world where there is where the individual governments have their freedom curtailed and are not allowed to do various things because it's contrary to the agenda that the globalists are following in terms of slowly merging all the countries of the world into super blocks like the Russian Federation, like the European Union, like the African Union, like the North American Union. All these super blocks are being created, and it's strange that it's uncannily it all resembles what was written about in 1984 and what was written about in by Aldous Huxley in Brave New World, and so this inexorable march towards a global totalitarian state seems to be continuing. And the hope that we must all harbour and must all nurture is that somehow, some way, in one of the great nations of the world, a leader comes along who has the ability to defy, and who has the skill within his of leadership, and has the loyalty of his people sufficient to defy this march towards globalism, and so retain a free world made up of sovereign independent states.
I think probably the only European leader we've got that fits that description is Viktor Orban. I mean, he's not too frightened to stand up against the European Union and speak his mind, and he has all the support of the public there. But it does seem to me that the Conservative Party are just sabotaged their future electoral success by doing this, by getting rid of the most popular leader that the Conservative Party have had for a long time, replacing them with somebody who really doesn't have any experience and has failed straight away. And now they're talking about just forcing Rishi Sunak on to everyone. And everybody's just, they've literally upset everybody that was supporting the Conservative Party by doing this, and it's all because they're just giving in to this media here. And just to finish up with Liz Truss, you were saying there about how you have these big multinational units now, like the European Union, like the Russian Federation. We've just left the European Union and we're supposed to be a sovereign state, and Liz Truss has just signed us up to a military compact with the European Union. So saying that all the forces are going to be united, all the defence forces, which I think was Macron's idea. So not we've only just managed to actually break free of the European Union, but straight away our leaders are trying to sneak us back in there through the back door with this defence pact. I don't know if you want to comment on that, Max, or shall we move into our eugenics presentation?
Well, that's just, it's another example of governments having an agenda which is not the agenda that is that is presented to the public, and whether Liz Truss is being dragged along against her will or whether she's going along freely, we can't know because we don't know what's in her head. But the fact of the matter is that, as you say, no sooner have we, as the public, taken a step towards reasserting our sovereignty, than it appears that our government is working against us in undermining our sovereignty again in a different way.
You sound like you must be a Russian bot there, Max. You're promoting Russian talking points that the European elites don't look out for the interests of the European nations anymore. But of course, people probably say the same thing about same thing about Putin, don't they? Right. Well, let's move into our presentation on eugenics in Britain, and we'll continue with our overview of eugenics. The eugenics movement became associated with Nazi Germany and the Holocaust when the defence of many of the defendants at the Nuremberg trials of 1945 to 1946 attempted to justify their human rights abuses by claiming there was little difference between the Nazi eugenics programmes and the US eugenics programmes. In the decades following World War II, with more emphasis on human rights, many countries began to abandon eugenics policies, although some Western countries, the United States, Canada and Sweden among them, continued to carry out forced sterilizations. And this is something that a lot of people are really sort of unaware of, because they see all this propaganda about eugenics and National Socialist Germany and the abuses of the disabled, and they're told that they sterilized the gypsies and all these other eugenics policies, negative eugenics policies that Germany actually had. But the same was going on in all the Western countries. The same was going on in America. And as it says here, this actually continued. This continued afterwards. But it was because of this link with eugenics and Nazi Germany, that's the reason why eugenics is looked upon as such a bad thing today. Because you would look at it and you would think, well, what's wrong with improving the stock of the race? As we saw last week, there was instances where they were saying, rather than actually looking at the race, they were looking at the citizens of a country and then thinking, well, we can improve the stock of the citizens of this country if we prevented black people from breeding because they have a lower average IQ. And this is what they were looking at back then. And that's the wrong way to look at it. They should have looked at it, well, we need to improve the stock of black people. So we need the blacks that have the higher IQ, they should be breeding. The ones that have the lower IQ, they should be encouraged not to breed. And then you would do the same with white people. But because we'd lost this understanding of the nation actually being linked to ethnicity, being linked to shared ancestry, they ended up using these eugenics policies on black people as well. Whereas I would suggest what they should have done is applied it to black people as a separate group to white people, and encouraged, as I say, that the people with a higher IQ amongst the blacks to breed more. Max, you got any thoughts on this about National Socialist Germany and their eugenics policies and what happened after the war to smear it?
Well, you're quite right that it was the fact that the National Socialist Government in Germany approved of the application of eugenics that created continual bad publicity for the eugenics movements elsewhere in the world. There was a tendency on the part of the eugenics movement, particularly in the United States, from my recollection, to apply eugenics negatively rather than to apply eugenic principles that were humane and that were like paternalistic, in the sense that there were laws in certain states within the United States where people, if they had an IQ below a certain level to the point where they couldn't function properly in a modern society, that they could be sterilized so that they wouldn't produce children, and where people were grossly physically deformed, that they were sterilized so that they wouldn't pass on their deformity to children. So it wasn't just Germany that sort of embraced those kind of ideas, but I think that the eugenics movement as a whole was not skillful enough in selling the benefits of eugenics by emphasizing that the key emphasis with regard to eugenics should be on the measures that are taken to increase the fecundity, the fertility of people who've got superior mental and physical characteristics, so that as each generation passes, it lifts the quality of the population, because that if you go around sterilizing people who have got physical or mental deficiencies of whatever, then what you're doing is you're removing from those people any possibility of them having a posterity. And when you remove the possibility of them having a posterity, they won't care about what happens for future generations, because whatever happens with future generations is going to have no relevance to them whatsoever. But if you have a society in which those people that have got the less attractive physical and mental features are encouraged, not compelled, but encouraged to limit their family size so that their reproduction rate is below the replacement rate, whereas people who've got more attractive mental and physical abilities are encouraged to have a reproduction rate which is greater than the replacement rate. And what it does is it means that the children of those people that have the less attractive physical and mental attributes will have a richer gene pool to find a mate within, and so produce children for the generation that follows. And every parent would want their child to have a richer gene pool within which to choose from, because no parent wants their child to have to settle for somebody who's got a less attractive physical and mental characteristics. Everybody's going to hope that their child meets somebody and marries somebody and produces children with somebody who's got superior qualities, so that it can uplift the quality of their grandchildren and their great grandchildren. That's what anybody, any right-minded person would want. And so if eugenics is portrayed in the correct way, then nobody really should have any objection to it. And if we were to apply eugenics, you know, if we work on the premise that the average IQ today is 100 across the world, it's actually lower than that. It's 100 across most of the most of Europe and the developed parts of the world, and across China. But in the third world countries, the IQs are lower than that on average, and so therefore the world's IQ is currently something like about 89 on the European scale. But if we were to apply eugenic principles across the world, then it would be possible to uplift The intelligence level of the world, which would be massively beneficial. It would reduce the amount of money that needs to be spent on social security and social support payments to people who can't work. It would mean that there would be far more people who are entrepreneurs, far more people who are geniuses when it comes to engineering or science, things of this sort. And it would open up a new golden age for mankind. Whereas the reluctance to look past the old mistakes that were made in terms of the early crude application of eugenics and look towards what could be done if we were to apply eugenics positively in the future. You know, it's just very sad that at the moment there aren't enough people in the world who've got the courage to speak up in favour of eugenics.
Yeah, people would still have a stake in society, wouldn't they? If you had people with genetic deformities and instead of having two children, they just had one child and each generation there would be less of them. But then they would still have this stake in society. They would still be wanting to take part in things. I mean, you can say, well, people would understand that if it was explained to them. But if you've got people that, don't have that very high IQ, then they're not really going to understand that. I mean, it is such a shame that what happened during World War II really did smear this science, because it is basically just based on common sense. Well, since the 1980s and the 1990s, with new assisted reproductive technology procedures available, such as gestational surrogacy, which has been available since 1985, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, available since 1989, and cytoplasmic transfer, first performed in 1996, concern has grown about the possible revival of a more potent form of eugenics after decades of promoting human rights. Again, so what they're talking about here is the fact that people that couldn't have children before are now able to have children through gestational surrogacy. And really, I guess that what the worry would be there is if they had some congenital deformity and that was being passed on. But then you've got this pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. So before the egg is implanted in the surrogate woman, there is a diagnosis done to check that the egg it's not going to be a deformed human being. It's not going to be somebody that has any of these congenital diseases. And I would say that is a good thing. But of course, they a lot of people say it isn't.
Yes, I mean we've had the first wave of people who've been promoting eugenics in the past, which, as I say, they failed to sell the idea properly, and in many cases the genetic principles were implemented in a crude way. Now we've got another tool in our toolkit, which is genetic engineering. And so as each year goes by, there is the potential for us to apply genetic engineering to eradicate congenital defects, whether they be mental defects or whether they're physical defects in future generations. And again, we've got the same people who have for decades now attacked and denigrated eugenics in its entirety, who are saying, oh, you know, these people that want to employ genetic engineering, they're just trying to create a super race. And they sort of, again, try to link the idea of genetics back to Nazi Germany, almost as if, you know, the babies that are created as a result of in vitro fertilization or whatever it turns out to be, as if these babies are going to pop out with a coal scuttle helmet and jack boots on. You know, it's just ridiculous. And what we should be looking at is the fact that, you know, by through the application of things like genetic engineering, through the application of encouraging the most talented people in our society to have more children, what we're doing there is we're just creating a better world where there are more talented people. And one of the factors that you can select for is empathy and the ability to sacrifice for others. And so a world molded by eugenics won't necessarily be a cold, hard world where severe measures are taken against people. It could be a warm, welcoming world where people are helped and where, as each generation goes by, the people that are born are better in every way than on average than the people that formed the previous generations.
Yeah, I think there's been less people with Down syndrome are born now. And I've seen some people that will come out, some mothers, and say, oh, but it's so lovely bringing up the Down syndrome people. And of course, they are innocent. But then when they become an adult, they become very hard to handle. And then if they're reproducing, you just got more people that are not actually living to the full extent of what humanity can live to. Because their bodies don't function quite right, or their mind doesn't function quite right. And one famous example of a test tube baby is Nick Fuentes. He's actually a test tube baby, and look at the success that he has had. So, you know, you could say, well, there's an example of this screening and working out which is going to be the best sperm and the best egg to be implanted, and you end up with somebody like Nick Fuentes. So he could end up with lots of people like him at some point in the future. But a criticism of eugenics policies is that regardless of whether negative or positive policies are used, they are susceptible to abuse because the genetic selection criteria are determined by whichever group has political power at the time. Furthermore, many criticise negative eugenics in particular as a violation of basic human rights, seen since 1968's proclamation of Tehran as including the right to reproduce. Another criticism is that eugenics policies eventually lead to a loss of genetic diversity, thereby resulting in inbreeding depression due to a loss of genetic variation. Yet another criticism of contemporary eugenics policies is that they propose to permanently and artificially disrupt million years of human evolution, and that attempting to create genetic lines clean of disorders can have far-reaching ancillary downstream effects in the genetic ecology, including negative effects on immunity and on species resilience. Well, how do they know that if we haven't actually gone down past these generations? And it's not really artificially interrupting millions of years of human evolution, because we always try to pick people that are examples of healthy genetics. You know, we want somebody that has a symmetrical face, for example. We want people that look beautiful if possible, and that basically shows that their genes are of good quality. They haven't got maladapted genes. They haven't got genes which aren't quite right. If people don't look quite right, then a lot of the time their thinking isn't quite right. And this is talked about a lot by Professor Edward Dutton. And this point here about determined by whichever group has political power at the time. I mean, we can all say that objectively you want somebody that is physically fit. You want somebody that has a high IQ. Somebody that is going to fully be able to make use of what a human body has to offer and what a human mind has to offer. And surely we all agree on those sorts of things. And it doesn't matter what political persuasion the government is going to be. Surely they are going to want people that have functional human bodies and functional minds. I guess what they're saying here is, you know, you could end up with a group that wants to get rid of the gypsies or a group that wants to get rid of the black people in society. But again, the way that this should be looked at is within these separate groups. So gypsies, they should be trying to get the best gypsy and encourage the best gypsies to reproduce. Black people, they should be encouraging the best black people to reproduce. And it shouldn't be looked at as in trying to improve the citizens of a country, which is what we get today, because of course we end up with people thinking that nations can actually be multicultural when really a nation is just an extended family, and the eugenics policy should be limited to that extended family. Once you start adding members of other people groups, then it's no longer eugenics. I mean, that would just be, well, I'm not sure, that would be some form of genocide, I think, rather than eugenics. Max, you got any views on this and about negative and positive policies?
Yeah, I think the people who worry about the things that you've just been talking about there are people who again are just looking for some negative aspect of eugenics that they can focus in on, and they can overstress and overinflate in order to prevent the eugenics taking place. And if you read, I mean, Aldous, it's many years now, many decades since Aldous Huxley wrote Brave New World, and in Brave New World he describes a world there where babies are born in a test tube, and where various chemicals are added to the test tube during their development in the test tube, which will then mean that they will develop differentially and so create children who are regarded as alphas, who are people who will then have very high intelligence and will have who will be good looking and have leadership skills and things like that, all the things that anybody would want in their children, whereas betas are people who've got a slightly lower intelligence, but who can still sort of exercise a certain amount of intelligent discretion. And then there are deltas and epsilons, and the epsilons basically are people who've been specifically bred to do all the very lowly things in life, to be, you know, cleaners or navvies or something like that, where it's predetermined that they don't need to have an active mind. They just need to have the physical wherewithal to do the physical work that's been set for them, and hopefully a low enough intelligence so they don't have get distracted by having thoughts of their own. And you know, that is the kind of nightmare scenario that Aldous Huxley painted in Brave New World. But that isn't what the eugenics movement actually wants to try and create. The eugenics movement wants to create a society where each successive generation is composed of more able people and better people from every possible perspective, in terms of their creativity, in terms of their sports ability, in terms of their artistry, as well as intelligence and as well as disease resistance and things of that sort. You see, a lot of modern day medicine is designed to enable people with diseases that previously would have killed them to survive and survive long enough to have children within the next generation. But the point is that if people who've got congenital susceptibility to certain illnesses, if they are reproducing at a rate greater than the replacement rate, then they will be increasing the number of people in each successive generation that need to have medical intervention. And the point is that if you have a National Health Service, and if the outcome of the National Health Service is that it creates in each successive generation a larger and larger number of people who are dependent upon a medical intervention by that National Health Service, then eventually that National Health Service is going to be totally overrun and will just not have the resources available to treat the patients in the way in which the patients would want to be treated, whoever their patients are. And that is sort of surprisingly like the National Health Service that we've got at the moment here in the UK. Whereas if instead of doing that over successive generations, there had been a policy of increasing the number of people that have got resistance to disease, and not stopping people who've got a lesser ability to resist disease from reproducing, but just encouraging those people to have to reproduce at a rate which is below the replacement rate, then what you would have is that each successive generation, the strain on the National Health Service would diminish, and there would be more money available for the more newer types of treatments that could make people even better. And so instead of it being a matter of excluding certain people, it'd be a matter of allowing everybody to march forward into a much brighter and a much healthier future.
Yeah, it seems like an unintended consequence of medicine and the NHS is that each generation gets weaker, because these people that would have ended up dying in childhood because they didn't have very strong disease resistance before end up growing on to adulthood, and they end up breeding and reproducing themselves. So really, to balance out medicine and to balance out the NHS, that there should be this eugenics policy to encourage the people that are disease resistant to create more of them, and that would then balance out medicine. But we never had that. So we end up with each generation being weaker than the last. Well, let's take a look at early eugenic practice here. Types of eugenic practices have existed for millennia. Some indigenous peoples of Brazil are known to have practiced infanticide against children born with physical abnormalities since pre-colonial times. In ancient Greece, the philosopher Plato suggested selective mating to produce a guardian class. And in Sparta, every Spartan child was inspected by the Council of Elders, the Gerousia, which determined if the child was fit to live or not. And I think what's going on here is what you see in the animal world as well. If an animal is born and it isn't quite how it should be, then you often find that the mother will leave the offspring, to expose, to die, eat the offspring, various ways to kill off the offspring, because they understand that they would not want that weakness being bred into the species, which is effectively what happens. I mean, I've read about this happening with birds. I'm sure it probably happens with cats and other creatures. If the offspring is not quite right, then it will end up dying. And if there's a lot of offspring there as well, that will naturally end up happening if you've got a litter there, because the fit animals will end up being able to get there to the milk, and the weaker animal won't actually be able to do that, so the weaker animal will end up dying off. And I think it was from observing what was happening in nature that gave the peoples these ideas. And as we see here, as it says here, you know, this was going on in Brazil before colonial times. Obviously, it wasn't white people that were encouraging them to do this. It was just a natural thing. And I guess in ancient times, you didn't have the system of the welfare state or the systems of charity that we have today. And if you had somebody that was born that was disabled and they were going to need looking after for the rest of their life, who was going to do that? I mean, it's just not possible to do. So even though it's a very sad thing, it was the best thing to do was just to leave them exposed. And I think in some cases they would leave them exposed on the mountainside. And this was the tradition. I think something like that is actually seen in one of the Hollywood movies, actually, about the Spartans. And the Spartans, or the Lacedaemonians, were known for being these fierce warriors. And part of the reason why they were such amazing warriors is because if the child was not absolutely perfect, they would be left and exposed on the mountainside. And so they really just had the very best examples of their race making up the actual tribe or the nation. Any thoughts on ancient eugenics?
Well, I think that the practices of the Spartans are an example of the negative application of eugenics. Although from the point of view of maintaining the fighting prowess of the Spartan warriors, it worked. What it has done is it's created ammunition in subsequent generations and subsequent centuries for people to say, "Oh, this is cruel," because you know had that child been nurtured, it may have been able to survive and have a reasonably normal life. And the point is that if a benevolent form of eugenics had existed during the times of the Spartans, then it's possible that in many cases that could be applied. I mean, we don't know quite what level of deformity we're talking about here, but let's just assume that it may have been possible for people with a degree of imperfection to have continued to lead a relatively normal life. And if they had been allowed to live on, but they were persuaded because of the advantages for their children and their children's children of living in a society where it's possible they would be able to, the likelihood that they would be able to meet and marry and produce children with people of better genetic stock, then the people that had the deformities that might have caused them to be exposed by the Spartans could have lived on and could have produced children, but at a less than replacement rate, so that, as I say, the Spartan society could still have improved generation by generation, but in such a way that it carried all of the people with it effectively. For eugenics to work and for it to be, it's got to be seen to be benevolent eugenics. It's got to be eugenics where everybody in the current generation is given, and unless they are absolutely sort of terribly badly deformed, everybody that's got the possibility of leading a relatively normal life should be afforded the ability to lead a normal life, and should have the benefits of people with their degree of disability being encouraged to have children at below a replacement rate, whilst people without the disability are encouraged to have children above the replacement rate. The benefits of that will be available not just to the children of the people who've got the more desirable genetic traits, but it will be available to their children as well, so that they could look forward to their children being of better quality than they are, and their grandchildren being of better quality than they are, etc. going into the future. The sad thing about eugenics is that the people who've tended to practice it have tended to always apply in a sort of negative sense instead of applying it in a benevolent sense, which carries everybody with the idea. And so that's the trick that we've got to pull off. Not that it's a trick. That's the key to the successful promotion of eugenics. By making people realise that not only will the progeny and the posterity of the best people amongst their society or nation be better off, but also their children and their children's children will be better off as well.
So it's kind of like a ruthless pursuit of perfection for the Spartans. They really weren't thinking about these people that were disabled living on at all. They were just thinking about being warriors. So I guess you could say at least we have advanced since then, and we think more about other members in society now. Well, the geographer Strabo states that the Samnites would take 10 virgin women and 10 young men who were considered to be the best representation of their sex and mate them. Following this, the best women would be given to the best male, and then the second best women to the second best male. It is possible that the best men and women were chosen based on athletic capabilities. This would continue until all 20 people had been assigned to one another. If the people involved dishonour themselves, they would have been removed and forcefully separated from their partner. So this is interesting, and this would fit in with what I was saying about if somebody has a perfect body, then they're likely to have a perfect mind as well, because the two are linked in together. So if you've got somebody that athletically looks very good and they're very good at what they're doing, then they're likely to mentally be very good as well. Have you heard of the Samnites? What do you think of this idea here, Max?
I haven't heard of the Samnites, but the Samnites are again an example of the negative application of eugenics, because what they're doing is they're forcibly putting people who've been objectively measured and valued by the leaders of their society, putting those people together and effectively compelling them to become a couple and to produce children. And you know, people aren't like that. People like to have the freedom to decide for themselves, but as a generality, people will tend to pick as their mate somebody that they regard as being of similar quality to themselves as a human, and so the people who've got the better qualities, providing those better qualities are promoted as such, the better qualities, rather than being denigrated unnaturally, then children will choose the better qualities, and so they will tend to choose superior physical types will tend to choose superior physical types. Superior mental types will tend to choose superior mental types. You've only got to see, this is something that happens quite naturally. So I don't think there's a need to sort of pair people up in the very rigid way that the Samnites apparently did. I think that, but it is again a matter of a value judgment being made upon everybody as they grow up. So if you have within a society a pastoral service which could take the part of the sort of service that priests and that the clergy have in previous centuries provided for their flocks, if instead of just concerning themselves with the spiritual aspects of life, if the clergy were involved in uplifting the genetic quality of the people within their flock, and if they were promoted based upon the degree by which they over time have been able to uplift the genetic quality of their flock, so that they effectively have got something to gain by making each successive generation better than it was before. And if they were then involved with the teachers, where they would look at children, look at their exam success, look at their sporting success, look at their mental development and whether they were honest and whether they were good people and whether they were benevolent. And if they picked out the children that have got all of the best attributes and encouraged those children to have encourage those people to reproduce at a rate which is above the replacement rate, that's really all that needs to be done. And if the priests providing the pastoral care were to take the children who have got lesser academic ability, who have got poorer sporting skills, and who exhibit mental characteristics that are undesirable, and if they spoke to them in a parental way and just explained to them that it was for the good of society if they restricted the size of their family and perhaps only had one or at the very most two children, and if the society also rewarded people for doing the right thing, and so that if somebody was regarded as having less desirable physical and mental characteristics, and they were encouraged by the pastoral service to have fewer children, and they complied with that and had fewer children, that they would be that they could even be awarded a medal, or they could be awarded an honour for their services to the future quality of their race. And those people who were judged to have throughout their schooling and upbringing to have superior qualities, if they were encouraged by the pastoral service to reproduce at a rate faster than the just replacement rates, so that they improved the future generations of society, they could win the same medal. In fact, you know, they could win the medal giving them an honour for having contributed towards the improvement of the future generations of their race. So both people with the less desirable characteristics and those with the more desirable characteristics could be rewarded for doing the right thing, and that's really all that you need to do.
Yeah, I think also what they're talking about there is arranged marriage, isn't it? You know, marrying off these two people that have been picked, and we've got the same thing that happens with royalty today. You know, King Charles was married off to Lady Di. That's just a famous arranged marriage recently, but all the way through history, monarchs have had to marry other monarchs. So it would seem to me that in itself was originating in a eugenics policy. But in the early years of the Roman Republic, a Roman father was obliged by law to immediately kill his child if they were dreadfully deformed. According to Tacitus, a Roman of the imperial period, the Germanic tribes of his day killed any member of their community that they deemed cowardly, unwarlike, or stained with abominable vices, usually by drowning them in swamps. Modern historians, however, see Tacitus's ethnographic writing as unreliable in such details. I mean, why would they think that was unreliable? I'm sure they've actually found the bodies of people that have been put into these swamps that were actually killed off by these Germanic tribes. So I think he was being quite honest here. And yeah, I think the Romans would have killed the child if it was dreadfully deformed. And I don't think it was just the Romans that were obliged to do that by law. I should imagine most peoples were. Any thoughts on Tacitus here and the Germanic tribes, Max?
Well, there have been bodies that have been found in bogs where the person concerned, it's usually men actually, although I think there have been some women that have been found in similar circumstances where their hands and their feet have been bound and they've been appear to be in a kind of like a fetal position. I don't think that they would have been people though that would have been killed as a result of being grossly deformed, because from the examples that I've seen where people there have been various books written. I think one of them was called The Bog People. It was just a sort of like a catalogue of all these various bodies that have been found in this way. Very often these people, there's never been any report of these people exhibiting any kind of deformities, so I don't think that being being drowned in a bog was necessarily something that was done for eugenic purposes.
Hang on, Max. That was for abominable vices.
Right. Okay. It could be for abominable. It could have been for those sort of things, or it could have been for anything. Really, it could have just been, you know, a type of rivalry, and you managed to capture the person that was your rival, and you may have decided to kill them in the past, and then you just threw the body in the bog so that it wouldn't be found. There's any number of explanations that can be that you can conjure up for why these bodies have been found in the bogs. But what I'm saying is that I don't see that there's any evidence to suggest that it was done for eugenic purposes. But by the other token, I can see that, you know, where a baby is born that is grossly deformed, then in those kind of societies, then it would have been natural for them to have been killed, because they would have led a miserable life had that not happened. You know, that there were lots of people who were born into sort of ancient societies or medieval societies where their only vice was the fact that they were poor. And where they've then had a terrible life, where they've effectively, because they had no home, no land, nobody to support them, etc., that they've been forced then to beg and things of this sort, or they've become criminals as a result of that. So the point is that if somebody was grossly deformed to the point where they couldn't lead a normal life, then the only humane thing to do would have been to have killed them as children, because otherwise they would have just had a miserable and, as I say, a very painful and torturous life.
Yeah, I think also what they're talking about here is adults, aren't they? You know, you're not going to be able to tell whether a child that's just been born is going to be cowardly, unwarlike, or staying with abominable vices. So drowning them in the swamps was not, you know, it wasn't out of a eugenic desire to improve the race. It was out of a desire to punish these people or get rid of these people, because they weren't any good. But they may have already been, you know, they were adults by that time. They may have already had descendants. So yeah, I agree, Max. You couldn't say that was a eugenics policy, although it probably did take place, because we have found these bodies in the bogs. Well, I think we'll leave that there then this week, Max, and we'll get into modern eugenics next week. So thank you very much for coming on today.
That's my pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.